This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. History's judgment on the presidency of George W. Bush may take a while, but conservative columnist Fred Barnes is ready now. Never mind the caterwauling of the establishment, says Barnes. Never mind the gripes of journalists and traditional Republicans and outraged Democrats, he says. In his new book, Rebel in Chief, Barnes describes the president from Texas as an insurgent visionary in the mold of FDR and Ronald Reagan, marching by his own compass, ready to remake the world, whether the world likes it or not. It looks like an awkward moment for the argument, with Bush trimming his sails, indictments dropping across Washington, hearings on the Hill. Small stuff, says Barnes. Up next on Point, conservative champ Fred Barnes on the glory of the rebel president. Joining me now from Washington is Fred Barnes, executive editor of the Weekly Standard and co-host of The Beltway Boys with Mort Kondracki on the Fox News Channel. He's author of the new book, Rebel in Chief, Inside the Bold and Controversial Presidency of George W. Bush. Fred Barnes, great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Tom, glad to be here.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Fred.
Cards on the table first,
Jack.
I think you used to be an editor of Fred Barnes, Jack. Have we got that right?
Yes, briefly at the New Republic. I had the pleasure of, I remember, editing a dispatch he wrote from South Korea, if I'm not mistaken.
So lo, these years ago. Fred Barnes, let's jump right into it. You were not so crazy about the President's State of the Union address. Said it's kind of mild and moderate, not as forceful as expected. So question is the rebellion still on?
Oh, I think the rebellion's still on, but it does fade a little bit in the sixth year, and President Bush has now moved into his sixth year as president, and the truth is a lot of the rebellion is still on the table, so he's got to deal with that. Already some conservatives and others think he's overreached, but he still has to deal with Iraq, his crusade for democracy, Iran, North Korea. He may want to return to an earlier part of his, what I would call a rebellion against at least Washington and its conventional wisdom, and that is to make an effort to reform some of the entitlements. He failed last year with Social Security, but he's itching to try it again if there's the slightest opportunity, but that opportunity does not exist this year.
You put George W. Bush up there with FDR and Ronald Reagan, big presidents who moved a lot around. The Los Angeles Times, Ron Brownstein says Fred Barnes doesn't so much assess Bush as measure him for Mount Rushmore. What about, is it too soon for this laudatory treatment of the president? I mean, by your own lights, as you say, 6 years in or going there, still a lot undone. How do you judge if the rebellion, if it's what you're for, is successful or not?
Well, I think we have to wait. Even Bush says that history will render the verdict on his presidency, and I think so too. I think I described some of these ventures he's taken that normal or that other presidents wouldn't. We know now FDR was essentially successful. I believe Ronald Reagan was essentially successful, but we don't know yet about George W. Bush. A lot depends on what happens in Iraq. A lot depends on whether he is successfully able to spread democracy or at least plant the seeds of democracy around the Middle East and elsewhere. And I think it also depends on whether he can return successfully to a reform agenda regarding entitlements. Look, that's a lot. We don't know the verdict, the final verdict on any of those.
You call the president an insurgent, you know, meaning out to undermine something, I guess, kind of working from within. In the last few days, and with the NSA hearings today on domestic surveillance and the president's orders there, even some conservatives are yelping about this. And where's this insurgency aimed, Fred Barnes? Is it undermining even conservatism?
Well, in some ways it is, and I go into that a good bit in the book. It was inevitable George Bush, being the kind of conservative he is, which is not the traditional conservative, that conservatives at some point would be unhappy, and they seem to be unhappier at the moment than they have been during the first 5 years of Bush's term. I mean, for instance, they don't like his view of the role of government. Bush accepts the fact that Ronald Reagan and Newt Gingrich and other conservatives failed to shrink the size of government. It's going to be big, and he wants to use it for conservative ends. They don't agree with his Medicare prescription drug benefit. They don't agree with his view on immigration, which Bush has basically a liberal position on. And they think his crusade for democracy is vast overreach. So he's been taking some criticism from conservatives in the last, really in the last year.
So how do you see it, Fred? You clearly are for the rebellion that you see here.
Mm-hmm.
But as you say, it's not traditional. It's big government conservatism. And now, the fear or allegation is it may even go at some civil liberties, some of the kind of civil liberties that conservatives hold dear. What's the vision? You know the president fairly well. You've been given a lot of access in your columns and doing this book. What is the sort of core vision here as you understand it?
Well, I don't, I don't know the president well personally. I've interviewed him once, one-on-one, in 5+ years. He doesn't call me and invite me by to come by and see the Super Bowl. Presidents don't have friends in the media anymore, and particularly this one. Even people who are relatively sympathetic to him and his presidency, as I am. But in any case, I think he really has two visions. One is his vision of democracy around the world, starting with Iraq and spreading to other countries in the Middle East. And it was fleshed out, I think, the most eloquently in his second inaugural address, January 20, 2005. And the other vision is of an ownership society in which power is transferred from Washington to individuals, and they will have more control over their the money. They will be able to invest in some of their Social Security payroll tax money. They will be able to decide more how to spend their health care money, and they will have utter flexibility in dealing with the money that's in investment retirement accounts. That's a different vision that would undermine to some extent the New Deal and the whole notion of government power growing in Washington. He's not trying to substantially reduce it because he thinks that's impossible, but this would certainly curb further growth.
You write that Bush is an alien in the realm of the governing class. He loves to smash conventional wisdom and destroy myths. What myths do you see him going at?
Well, one of the myths is when you come to Washington, you have to come to terms with the Washington establishment. Ronald Reagan did. Bush hasn't. Another myth is presidents don't put their prestige and presidency on the line in midterm elections. President Bush did in 2002, and we saw it, and he was helped by changing his position on the Homeland Security Department, but it worked for him in 2002. Another myth is that you need to hire old hands from Washington because they're experienced, they can help you, they can teach you, you won't make mistakes if you hire them. Bush hadn't hired any of them or any in any great numbers anyway. He's really stuck with his original group of people that include a lot of Texans.
So how do you see the rebellion going now, Fred? You I guess the book kind of has a taproot that goes back to a column you wrote in 2004. The president was mm-hmm. on a big reelection campaign, was riding fairly high, and you wrote at that time that it's the insurgents versus the Washington establishment, and mm-hmm. the insurgents are winning. So now the president's pulled in his horns a little bit, at least in the State of the Union address, taken a heck of a walloping in the polls, mm-hmm. had rough time with Katrina, Iraq. You know, you can point at elections, but then also there's a lot of unease about how things are going there. Are the insurgents mm-hmm. still winning?
Well, the president certainly didn't have a great 2005. It was sort of one big bump in the road, and you mentioned a number of the reasons it was. I'd already mentioned Social Security reform not
yep.
being enacted.
No traction.
Harriet Myers is a Supreme Court justice. That was not exactly inspired. So the president has hit a bump in the road. On the other hand, I think Iraq, a sharp turn has been made there for the better, not only with the three elections that have been successful, but with the building of an effective Iraqi army that's still being built, but there is progress there, and we'll see when they form a government, which has to happen the sooner the better. I would say the one thing that the president seems unlikely to really be successful at is entitlement reform. Even though his new budget would trim some money for Medicare, that's not reform. I mean, you can cut spending without reforming. You can raise spending without reforming. And so that one's going to be hard to do. He's looking for opportunities for that, but I think what would have to happen, if there's going to be serious entitlement reform, Republicans will have to fool everyone again and do extremely well in the midterm election this fall Right now, it doesn't look like that's going to happen.
Jack Beatty, you've followed Fred Barnes for a long time. You've watched this president. He says there's an insurgency underway here, and the president is the rebel in chief. How do you see it?
I think there's a lot to that. I mean, he has been, a rebel against that Washington establishment and against conventional, metrics of presidential success. Bush has said, no, don't judge me that way. Judge me this way. And but, you know, even rebels have to be competent rebels, and their rebellion has to be competently conducted. And there, it seems to me, there's a real gap. I mean, competence and transparency. When you look at the Iraq War, I mean, right from the beginning, throwing out plans that would have done a better job. Why? We don't know. But not competently run. No Child Left Behind. A bureaucratic nightmare to hear Fred's own state of Virginia talk about it. Even Utah, a Republican state, feels that way. Katrina, the president didn't seem to be even on top of what was happening in the days after it. The Medicare prescription drug bill, again, the administration represented it as costing $400 billion, and sure enough, a couple of months later, we found out, no, that really wasn't the estimate. They suppressed the real estimate. It was going to be $700 billion.
Mary is calling from Florence, Massachusetts. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I hardly know where to begin. First of all, I'll just say I usually really love this show, but today I'm really disturbed by how the conversation is being framed, period. The notion of a lone rebel cowboy president, you know, in a democracy is incredibly disturbing, first of all. Second of all, the idea that a guy who's a totally entrenched, privileged millionaire member of the millionaire oil baron elite is a rebel is completely absurd to me. Third, just a regular person on the ground here watching a president who frequently can hardly form a sentence and is frequently not there in times of disaster, i.e. Katrina or whatever, I don't see some lone rebel guy with some grand vision. I see a guy surrounded by handlers who are kind of shadowy and scary, like Karl Rove, for example. And I just, you know, like I said to the person who answered my phone call, to me, the emperor has no clothes.
Mary, we're here, and we've got all 3 points. Let us put them to Fred Barnes. Fred, maybe first, Mary says, look, how can this be a rebel? This is a rich guy born to political aristocracy, entrenched in the establishment from birth anyway. How can he be described as a rebel now? What do you say to that, Fred?
Well, that was certainly true of Theodore Roosevelt. It was certainly true of Franklin Roosevelt. So I think it can easily happen. The president's views of Washington were shaped by his earlier times in Washington, indeed when his father was president. But they are quite different from almost anybody I've run into among conservatives or others who come into Washington at any level. The fact of his background doesn't delegitimize them.
What about the picture of George Bush as the object of handlers? This, is, of course, mm-hmm. has been a view for a long time, lots of talk mm-hmm. about it. Many people just assumed he had to be a puppet of Dick Cheney and others. Mm-hmm. Mary sees him that way. How do you see him?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's wrong. I know how White Houses operate because I've been covering them off and on since Gerald Ford was president back in the 70s. And one, I think it's impossible for anyone else to have enormous influence. The way it's structured is the president himself is the one who makes the decisions. And this is true of every White House. We always have this story. It was true with Ronald Reagan. It was true even with LBJ. There were stories about excessive influence by certain aides. And I do not believe that the president is run by Karl Rove or Dick Cheney or Don Rumsfeld or Condoleezza Rice. And I think one of the things in this book I did try to document was that the president is the chief decision maker and comes up with at least some of the ideas himself. And is, Tom, we've heard the opposite criticism recently, that the president's in a bubble and he's not hearing from anybody outside, and so he's basically out of it.
Well, but that's a little different critique. That way. But that's saying he's in a bubble, I think most people assume, with a few advisors. Mm-hmm. What's the mm-hmm. the evidence that you've come up with in the book for Bush as, you know, master of his own program here?
Mm-hmm.
Give us some nuts and bolts insight into what you see.
Good. Well, there were a series of meetings in the spring of 2002, when the Middle East, and particularly Israel and the Palestinians, was on the table. It was Bush who came up with a couple of ideas. It was Bush. And look, I had an open mind on this going into it, though I didn't think presidents could ever be pushed around by aides or heavily all that their decisions that heavily influenced by aides. But anyway, I had an open mind about it and found that it was Bush who decided to ostracize Yasser Arafat, the Palestinian leader, and have no more mm-hmm. Americans dealings with him. It was Bush who made the decision that rather than stop any progress in or any serious talks until the Palestinians totally gave up terrorism, the president said, I think we have to flip that on its head. The most important thing there is democracy, to establish democracy. Now, this obviously is controversial now because this was followed, and now Hamas has been elected as the majority of the party that will govern the Palestinians. So Hamas, a terrorist group, but it was the president who made that decision.
And we saw Dennis Ross, if I read him right, in the New York Times mm-hmm. over the weekend saying, you know, it was President Bush's kind of shoving this off of center stage that has led to Hamas winning. Dennis Ross, no supporter of Hamas, but saying it didn't have to be this way if the U.S. had been more involved, not less. Does this fall in the success category for President Bush or the failure category?
And I'm trying to think whether I've read so many pieces by Dennis Ross, and he's certainly someone I admire. I didn't read that column. I thought I did, but I didn't read it that way. I don't think so. If that's the case, I mean, if there'd been more tinkering and compromise, and I don't think there really was anything that could have pushed.
Dennis Ross is saying
he
said they didn't give enough support to the Palestinians once they started getting into this democratic chain. We saw Condoleezza Rice saying after Hamas. Victory. We haven't been paying enough attention here.
In other words, we didn't. The U.S. didn't give enough money to the Fatah-run Palestinians, which are well known now for being almost totally corrupt.
I'm just putting
that makes much sense.
Just putting Dennis.
I like
Ross.
Dennis.
We do too. Let me ask you about Mary's. Maybe what is the fundamental mm-hmm. point here? She says mm-hmm. she's not comfortable with the idea of the lone rebel cowboy pulling the country off in his direction. It sounds anti-democratic to her.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say?
That doesn't. He was elected twice. That may create anxiety on her part, but he was elected twice, and he, you know, the phrase cowboy was thrown around, obviously, at Ronald Reagan. Lone, he's not. Look, the president is the chief decision maker and comes up with some of the ideas. I thought Mary, he's not lone. Even Mary suggested that his handlers are the ones in charge. I don't think they really are, but nonetheless, look, he's a president of the United States. He's elected twice. There are great limits on his power by Congress and the courts and so on. He's not a lone cowboy running the country and taking it wherever he wants, because he's been there as often happens to presidents, the places they want to take the country, Congress balks at.
But what do you say about this? There's a kind of implicit critique there of the very notion of a rebel in the White House. I mean, Bush's victory, mm-hmm. 2004, in percentage terms, the smallest, I think, ever for a reelected president. So does Mary have a point that a president, especially one elected by that slim a margin, mm-hmm. needs to pay attention to the center? Or, as you see it, is the president free to go off in whatever direction that portion, no matter how narrow the majority that elected him, wants? He's free to go.
Well, I know. I think he's free to go off on the agenda that he campaigned on and was clearly elected on. That's the way politics works in America. That's what a Democrat would do. That's what any president would do, whether they were a rebel or not. The president is I call him rebel in chief. Obviously, it's a play on commander in chief, and it's designed as a catchy title, and it seems to have caught people's eye. He's a rebel because of the way he governs. He doesn't rely on the Washington establishment. He doesn't rely on the foreign policy community, much of which works for him at the State Department. He doesn't rely on permanent Washington. He doesn't participate in Washington society. Look, if he relied on the advice of the foreign policy community in Washington, including people like Brent Scowcroft, who worked for his father, mm-hmm. there would have been no invasion of Iraq. There would be no crusade for democracy around the Middle East and elsewhere. If he relied on the political establishment, there certainly would have been no effort to reform Social Security last year. And maybe the advisors were right. It didn't work. But in those ways, he's a rebel. Now, most presidents try to have at least social relations. Ronald Reagan certainly did with Washington and the establishment. Remember when Ronald Reagan came to town, there was his famous party at Catherine Graham's mm-hmm. house. She was then the publisher of the Washington Post. Bush didn't do anything like that. I asked him why he doesn't participate at least socially in Washington, and he said he's too busy. He carries work home back to the residents of the White House.
And home is
the best
right
answer was Karl Rove. Let me just add one thing. The best answer was what Karl Rove told me. And I said to the question, why is Bush so averse to Washington? And he said M&M. I didn't know what that was, but he said Midland, Texas, where the president grew up, which is a small city with small city values or small town values. And then the other M is Methodism, which grew up in England in the 18th century, basically the working man's faith. His father was an Episcopalian. He's a Methodist.
And now the stage is the whole country. Aubrey's, or the whole world for that matter. Aubrey's calling from Orangeburg, South Carolina. Hi, Aubrey. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I'd just like to agree with Mr. Rove there. I'd like to disagree with this notion that the president is in a bubble. I think he's just taking a stance as a leader, and Democrats are getting really angry at him because he's not taking all their suggestions. But really, I don't hear many suggestions from them. All I hear is criticisms.
Aubrey, let me ask you, are you supportive of what Fred Barnes calls big government conservatism as opposed to small government Ronald Reagan conservatism?
Well, I think that it's a means to an end. As a businessman, I'd like the government to, stay out of it as much as possible. When you're in the business that I am, you have to deal with the Department of Transportation and all these new rules and laws, and government is just getting more and more complicated. I think that Bush is just doing his best to try to scale that down, shrink government and make it more manageable.
Well, maybe. Fred is looking toward a different scale, but we hear your basic support, Aubrey, and we thank you for calling. Let me get another call here as well from Yardley, Pennsylvania. Jerry's calling. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Good morning, Tom.
Hi.
Nice to hear someone who's presenting a point of view that I wholly agree with. I think when we think of rebels in chief, I think we could even go back to people like Abraham Lincoln, who, at that present time, probably was kind of viewed by many as being a rebel. Certainly taking the country to war internally was probably viewed in quite a negative light. And I think only the proper perspective to look at Bush long term will be from a historical perspective 20, 30, 40 years from now. And I believe that what he's done for this country and what he's contributed in the long run will make a huge difference, not only for this country, but for the world as well. So I appreciate hearing Fred's comments.
So bring it on, you say, Jerry, and we've got it putting Abraham Lincoln. That's a little bit of a spin there. It was the rebels he was fighting, but I take your point. Fred, I'll come to you, but let me just ask Jack first. The idea of a rebel presidency, Fred says it's in part a catchy title, but he's got the insurgency theme throughout the book. I know you, Jack, have supported different kinds of rebels. Maybe not the George Bush style so much, but FDR, a pretty strong favorite of yours. What about the idea itself of a rebel in the White House as opposed to a caretaker?
Well, I think Jimmy Carter said this recently about President Bush. He used the word radical, though. He said that no president before Bush had ever made a preemptive attack on another nation that had done no harm to us. He said that no president before had so taken down the wall separating church and state regarding aid to faith-based organization. And he made other comments about Bush's changes on the environmental front, which he called radical. And if you call it that way, it doesn't sound so attractive. Usually presidents are not, we don't want our presidents to be radical. And Bush didn't really run so much as a radical. But on the question of rebel, I mean, what is the motivation of this rebel? Is there really a personal motivation there, too, not just an ideological one or a political one? That is he in some way driven to rebel against his father and against his father's standards and his father's advisors and his father's worldview? Again and again, this comes up with Bush. We heard it in the State of the Union address, where out of the blue, he said, two of my father's favorite people, Bill Clinton and me. Well, you know, his whole biography is about his father putting other people ahead of him. Is this rebel still working out of that familial cause?
Fred Barnes, what do you say?
I haven't the slightest idea. I suspect not, but I have no way of knowing that. I can't get in George Bush's brain. And, you know, look, sons are quite different from their fathers. Frequently, brothers are quite different. Look at Teddy Kennedy, quite different from his brother, John F. Kennedy, in a political ideology. So I have no idea whether he is somehow working out his relations with his father. Look, his father was a New Englander who grew up there, who in Washington moved rather smoothly and enjoyed it. George W. Grew up in Midland, Texas, and was really, from what I can tell, more conservative than his father from his teenage years and when he went to college. So I think they're, as best I can tell, they're different for normal reasons, but if there's something else there, I just don't know about it.
Well, but you've paid pretty close attention here. What about on the personal side? How do you mm-hmm. interpret the motivations of the rebel? You look at George Bush's mm-hmm. faith, religious faith, mm-hmm. so you're yes. not shy about getting in close here. How do you interpret the most personal motivations here?
I'm not shy about getting in close about his faith because he's talked about it a bit. I've interviewed him about it, and so I think it's a little easier to know that. Look, his political views his view of the establishment in Washington was really shaped by his two times in Washington before he was president, once in 1988 when he came to town to help his father get elected president, and then again in 1992 when he came to help his father get reelected, and of course his father failed. And the president in 92 really had developed a sour, negative attitude toward Washington. He saw he thought the press was mercilessly kicking his father while he was down. He thought the town has this idea that you're up or down, and his father was down, and people treated him badly. He thinks people even on the president's staff bailed out on his father when he was running for reelection, didn't give the full effort. And so he basically turned against permanent Washington, and he brought that with him when he came back in 2001. And I think that's why I've called him an insurgent or a rebel, and I think those things fit.
And the notion of Bush as a rebel or a radical, do you welcome George W. Bush as a radical, Fred Barnes?
Well, I don't think he is a radical, and if he were, I wouldn't... I don't think I'd welcome him. Of course, these same things were said about Ronald Reagan back in the 1980s. He was in a bubble. He didn't make his own decisions, all these things. Some of these are just sort of hardy perennials of journalism.
Preemptive war, church-state wall, those are not exactly nothing. I mean, those are not just shrubs in the garden.
Has the wall been broken down? I don't think it's really been broken down.
Rob is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Rob. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hello, sir. What do you think?
I just wanted to ask Mr. Barnes, we'll accept the fact that this is a rebel, that he's doing extraordinary, unusual things, not always in compliance with the law, apparently, but at a time when so much is at stake, are we really in better shape having a rebel rather than someone more prudent? I heard earlier this morning on NPR that our debt is $400 billion, which is about the amount that we're spending in Iraq. Will my teenage daughter not be better off as she comes into her majority if she's in fact living in a country which has no deficit rather than one which has a $400 billion deficit and maybe getting something we don't like in Iraq at the end of it anyway?
Rob, stand by. I want to get Fred Barnes to respond and then hear what you have to say. Mm-hmm. Rob, Fred, what do you say to that? Would we be better off with the prudent presidency, the word attached to Bush Sr.?
Well, nobody seemed to think so at the time with Bush Sr. Look, the one thing I appreciate about Bush and why I wrote this book is because he is a rebel. I've lived in Washington almost my whole life. I've been a reporter and writer here for 30-plus years. Mm-hmm. And to see the status quo, to see a president's brought to heel, to see the Washingtonization of members of Congress who come here and stay more than a few years is very distasteful to me. It's why we wind up with a Washington that is a city of parasites in many ways. In fact, I almost wrote a book about that subject before. You know, I don't think the deficit is going to doom the caller's daughter. The deficit actually right now is much smaller in terms of in its percentage of gross domestic product than it was during the Reagan years, when it was thought to be something that was going to ruin the country and didn't. So I personally don't worry about the deficit and or the president, because he's not a prudent man like his father. I mean, his father's presidency was, I think, pretty much of a failure, except with the one exception of the first Gulf War in 1991. And I wanted to say, Tom, if I can have just a second, you referred to Ronald Reagan as a small government conservative.
Mm. Yes, that was certainly his line.
That
chop
was his
it
line,
down,
exactly.
Whack it down, yeah.
I think you have it right. That was his line, and but he was rhetorically only a small government conservative. You know, one of his things was to get rid of the Department of Education. Mm. Spending grew rather substantially in that department during his presidency. David Stockman, his budget director, when he came out with his book in 85 or 86, he said, you know, in domestic policy, the Reagan Revolution had been a failure. So the truth was, Ronald Reagan, I think, was a great president in many ways, but not because he was achieved smaller government.
Rob,
simply didn't.
We got it. Rob,
and
come
he
back.
He didn't try very hard to.
Well, he sure talked a lot about it. He left that
he
as a kind of a huge marquee billboard up there. Rob, come
I
back
know,
to us here, if I may, Fred.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
That was an answer worthy of a presidential spokesperson. The thrust of my question is that this rebel has put my daughter's future in hock. My question was about $400 billion that it looks like it's going to be purchasing us some sort of Islamic theocracy, and my question was to Mr. Barnes, would my daughter not be better off if that $400 billion had been spent on education, health care, all sorts of things that are going to be very important?
You're talking about the money spent on the war in Iraq. Yeah, the money spent on the war. Fred, what do you say?
Well, I disagree. I think the war did. I think the war in Iraq is crucial. It's crucial to it's crucial to America's national security. It's crucial for what America stands for in the world, which is not a country that's isolated, that's locked up with walls around it. And I suspect her daughter's going to do just fine. The deficits during the Reagan years or the Clinton years, except for the last couple, didn't doom her, and I don't think these will either. They're small in terms of the gross domestic product, and I don't think we're going to get a theocracy in Iraq either.
What about the anger towards George W. Bush around that world that Rob's daughter will inherit? Fred, it is really unmissable. I mean, you just cannot get away from it these days. You step outside these borders, and there's a lot of disillusionment at one end and fury at the other, and lots of it. Mm-hmm. What about that as a George W. Bush legacy?
Well, you know, there's always going to be a certain amount of anti-Americanism around the world. There was a lot during the Reagan years. Remember that? Remember those huge demonstrations against Reagan, much larger than the ones against Bush? Look, it is. He's unpopular around the world. Should he not have pursued policies he thought were right because they make him personally unpopular around the world, particularly in the Middle East and in the Arab world? I don't think so. I mean, should he not have responded as he did to 9/11? Declaring it a war rather than merely an action that needed strict law enforcement? I don't think so. I think he's done things that were bound to anger people around the world and have, but in most cases I think they're the right things.
Jack Beatty, I heard you there.
Well, I was going to say that Rob's daughter has got even a heavier road to hoe than he may realize. Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, recently estimated that the true cost of this war will actually be $2 trillion when you factor in the cost of all the veterans' benefits into the future and other things. So not $400 billion, but perhaps $2 trillion.
Fred, when are you going to judge whether the war is a success? You give a lot of credit to the president for the elections that we've seen there, but
right.
at the same and making progress on the Iraqi military. At the same time, you know, we see the killing that still goes on. We're reading just the last couple of days about the divisions within armed and paramilitary groups in Iraq. There's still the chance of a civil war. When do we judge whether or not that was a success?
Well, one, there has to be no civil war. Two, there has to be a government involving including Shiites, Kurds, and Sunnis in a substantial way. And three, there has to been a de-escalation, which I think is already happening, in the insurgency. When you get those three things together, I think you can wind up with a reasonably stable democracy that Iraq has never experienced before, and one that gives us real hope for the future.
But it's only one out of those three where you're prepared now to begin to claim some surety of success. That means it's really still an open question. Why are you so supportive of something that at such high cost, that's still an open question whether it'll be a success or not ultimately?
Well, I think there's a better than a 50-50 chance it's going to be a success. Part of it is to establish his government. I think we'll know in a matter of weeks whether that's going to happen or not, and I think it will. The insurgency's losing ground. We now know that some of the jihadists from outside Iraq have been fighting against some of the Sunni insurgents from inside Iraq. So I think that's turning in the right direction. So I'm optimistic about Iraq.
Bill's calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen. Wonderful to talk to all of you. I haven't heard about your book until today, but I obviously, now that I've heard about it, I'm certainly going to go get a copy of it. I'm very interested in it. We could talk all day about the president, and as somebody who has firmly supported him right from the outset, I voted for him twice. I believe in what he's doing. I don't always agree with how he goes about doing things, but that's just a matter of his style versus what I think might be right. But then again, he's there and I'm not. One thing I've always been impressed with the president is he does not seem to be bothered by what popular opinion says. He looks at what he does as a matter of what is right and what is wrong, and ultimately and most importantly, what is right for America, or certainly what he believes is right. And I guess as a question, and as you have spoken to the president personally, I interviewed him on a number of occasions, publicly he does not let these things bother him, but behind closed doors, you know, when he's at home, does it eat at him that he's not getting the kind of positive response from the public that he would probably have hoped for when he's made decisions?
Bill, we'll go to that, but let me ask you first. You said you're happy to have a president who decides these things on his own without paying so much attention to popular opinion. In a democracy, is that really what you want in a leader?
Absolutely, because leadership is never about popularity. In a small-scale way, I have been in positions of leadership,
mm-hmm.
and very often you have to make decisions that are unpopular, but ultimately the decisions you make are based on what you know to be right to achieve the goals that you have in mind.
Bill, we've got it. Let me put your question to Fred Barnes. Fred, does the president, I can hear your answer coming on this, but does he privately mm-hmm. agonize about the resistance and moaning about some of his policies, the rough feedback from some of the public?
Well, you know, aides of his say he doesn't, but I suspect he does, particularly the deaths of soldiers in Iraq. Is something that's bound to wear on him. And I think a president, well, this is the least poll-driven president ever, I think. And we don't want a poll-driven president who is driven by the polls, I don't believe. I think he would, particularly when it comes to Iraq, really like to have more public support, because that helps when you're carrying out something as audacious as this effort in Iraq to not only throw out the dictator but create a democracy there. So when I talk to him, and he seems to be the least agonizing guy in town, but there are bound to be moments when he does agonize.
What about this issue of a president who consults his own personal compass and goes? What about the half of the country that didn't vote for him? How do you look at that in a democracy, Fred? You know, does that mean they're fools and misguided? That he can go off in an entirely different direction without them? Does it work for that to happen in a democracy?
Well, they are represented in Congress, after all. There is a Democratic Party that had its own candidate who lost for a number of reasons, and but the president runs on certain things. Now, I suspect that many people who criticize this president, who happen to be liberals, if they had a president who had campaigned on a liberal agenda and won, they would expect him, even if he or she won narrowly, to pursue that agenda. And that's basically what Bush has done.
David's
as a conservative.
Yeah, David's calling from Polly's Island, South Carolina. David, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I voted for Bush the first time around, and in my mind, he is in no way a conservative, certainly not fiscally. He's expanded government tremendously. He's his Medicare drug prescription program is a buy-off for the drug industry. And on his international foreign policy, he's destabilized the Middle East. And I think we're going to end up with a theocracy in Iraq in Iraq, and the main beneficiary is going to be Iran. And I think he's going to go down as a president who never vetoed a bill, and he's going to be the worst president in the last 100 years.
There's a tough judgment, and we hear it, David. Thanks for your call. Let's get a couple more calls here. Tony's calling from Merrimack, New Hampshire. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Thank you. I consider Bush to be a rebel, but only in the average. In other words, I think he's sometimes a radical, as I agree with President Carter. And then on other issues, he seems to be very limp-wristed. And I've been speaking specifically about his energy policies in the State of the Union address. Everything that he addressed was basically, at best, midterm, really long-term. A true radical would have said, we've got a real problem with oil. We're going to reimpose a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. We're going to do rationing or something to that effect.
Right, step up stronger than that.
Yes, much stronger, something that's going to have an immediate effect that is basically going to reduce the consumption of foreign oil below 20%, and therefore we're no longer held hostage to the Middle East.
So if he's a rebel, not a tough-enough rebel on that front for you, Tony, and we hear that. Let me get one more call here from Weston, Massachusetts. Isabella's calling. Hi, Isabella. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, I think that a better title for this president would be traitor-in-chief. I think he's betrayed the American people in many ways, and most particularly leading us into an unjust war based on a pack of lies. I think he's betrayed our Constitution, which he swore to uphold, and I sincerely hope that the congressional hearings that are being held today are a first step towards his impeachment. And I believe that this will happen if Americans vote in a Democratic Congress in this year's election.
Isabella, we hear it, and I appreciate your call. I'll get one more. Joseph's calling from Peabody, Massachusetts. Hi, Joseph. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I think it's all a red herring, and there has not been much discussion at all of the fact that each time Bush picks a topic like Social Security, it diverts attention completely. Sunday morning and all those other experts that are on, they get pulled over into discussing what George wants them to talk about while the war goes on. Now this is not an important topic that they're on now with the surveillance.
Yes, the NSA surveillance, yeah.
But that's the same thing. George can sit there smiling. It's going to come out in favor of the president. The president predominates over Congress all the time.
And the Iraq war goes on. Our time is short, but we hear your unhappiness with that. Fred Barnes, where do you think this is heading? When George Bush finally heads home to Texas, as you say you expect he'll gladly do, is he likely to head home a satisfied rebel or something less? How do you call it?
You know, I suspect something less. I know the president believes, and because he told me this when I interviewed him for an hour, and last July the interview actually occurred after I'd finished writing the book, but there was still time to put a lot of quotes in. And he said the verdict won't come until well after his presidency is over, and I think that's probably true. We're not going to know the final outcome in Iraq on democracy, on entitlements and things like that. Look, he may be long gone from the scene, from this earth before a final verdict is rendered. He brought up a subject with me that I thought was interesting because I hadn't asked about it, and that is George Washington. Now, obviously, there was no reason for me to ask him about George Washington, but he'd read three books last year on Washington, 1776 and His Excellency, and what was the third one? Washington Crosses the Delaware. Mm. And he raised this point, and that is Washington was the first president more than 200 years ago, and he and his presidency is still being reassessed, reevaluated. And so he wondered, well, what will they be saying, hundreds of years or 50 years or 100 years from after my presidency? And he asked particularly whether the historians would think he was too optimistic, too optimistic about changing the world. Mm. And this is something that has occurred to him where his legacy and how successful it is, we won't know for a while.
And now
the final verdict, anyway.
Yeah, and you write more recently. He's now reading or about to read about Mao Zedong.
I think he's read that book.
We'll watch out on that front. Fred Barnes, we've got to let you go. Our time is up. The new book is Rebel in Chief. Fred, thanks very much for being with us.
Tom, I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
Jack, final word goes to you.
Well, the Wall Street Journal did a survey of presidential historians. Not surprisingly, the Democratic-leaning ones thought he was the sixth worst. The Republican-leaning ones, the sixth best.
There's a range. Rebel goes on. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.